All right, here we are again, Neighborhood Public Radio, in your neighborhood, maybe. Up next is Amber Hasselbring. She's an environmental artist from the Bay Area, and she's here visiting her good friends at Neighborhood Public Radio. She's going to be doing some reading in a minute, but first we're going to ask her a little bit about, to explain a project that she's working on at the moment in San Francisco called the Mission Greenbelt Project, and that's something that's in process now, and what can you tell us about that?
Yeah. Hi, Alex. Yeah, it is in process now. It started last November with a gallery show at the San Francisco Arts Commission Gallery. They accepted my proposal to turn their space into campaign headquarters for the project. Okay. Speak louder into the microphone. So during the campaign, we just a public awareness campaign about the idea of building sidewalk gardens in San Francisco. Sidewalk gardens are removal of concrete and replacing concrete with gardens, so that people have not only trees to walk by, but also gardens to protect them from the street traffic and beautify the neighborhoods and create communities. So this greenbelt will connect two parks in San Francisco's Mission District, and will be made of all native plant gardens, which is pretty exciting to me because there are about 300 varieties of plants that grow naturally native in San Francisco. Really special, unique place that has that kind of diversity of plant life. If we're able to grow these native plant gardens, then there will be just more possibility for life and, you know, less need for maintenance and water. And water is a problem in California, as it is in New York. So that's a little bit about the project.
Now, have you heard of any, have there been any groups that have come to you complaining about the possibility of plant abuse? You know, kind of bringing all these plants and putting them in, you know, in a really dangerous sort of situation for their own health, or is this something that anybody has considered?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's a little bit why I'm here in New York, to see what urban warfare is like on the plants, because you have people and you have dogs and you have just people falling into plants and people riding their bikes over it. So if you have some protection, is one of the best things that you can do for these gardens. Gates and
right. I think most of it is the first foot or two off the ground is probably the most vulnerable.
Yeah, yeah. So they will need to be protected because the pH of dog pee just doesn't do well for plants, unfortunately.
Well, so that will be something that can be viewed later once it's complete, or is there an ongoing viewing of that on the website?
It's ongoing. If you Google Mission Greenbelt, you'll be able to find some information on the project.
And that's at art-echo.org.
Correct.
Right. Okay.
Thank you, Alex.
All right. Well, now we're going to turn it over to Amber completely. She's going to do some reading, and she'll just tell you what that is. All right.
Great. Thank you. So what I'm going to be reading today is some nature writings by Rachel Carson. And the reason I've chosen Rachel Carson is because her environmental writings have just been so influential to the contemporary environmental movement, of which we're all learning so much about right now. So the two books she's written four books completely. Two of the most influential books are The Sea Around Us, written in, 1951, and Silent Spring, written in 1962. Silent Spring was really a call to arms for environmentalists because it talked about things like DDT and other carcinogens that we were putting into onto plant life and agriculture to feed people and to just get to contemporary agricultural practices. But she's also very eloquent about the way she understands and writes about nature. So I'm going to read you a piece of hers that wasn't part of one of her books, but a separate writing called Biological Sciences. The scope of biology can be truly defined only in broad terms as the history of Earth and all its life, the past, the present, and the future. Any definition of lesser scope becomes narrow and academic and fails utterly to convey the majestic sweep of the subject in time and space, embracing all that has made man what he is and holding a foretaste of what he may yet become. For it has dawned upon us in these recent years of the maturing of our sciences that neither man nor any other living creature may be studied or comprehended apart from the world in which he lives. That such restricted studies as the classification of plants and animals or descriptions of their anatomy and physiology upon which the early biologists necessarily focused their attention are but one of the small facet of a subject of so many-sided, so rich in beauty and fascination, and so filled with significance that no informed reader can neglect it. In the truest sense, there is no separate literature of biology or of any science. Knowledge of the facts of science is not the progressive of all number of men isolated in their laboratories, but belongs to all men, for the realities of science are the realities of all life itself. We cannot understand the problems that concern us in this or our particular moment of time unless we first understand our environment and the forces that have made us what we are physically and mentally. Biology deals with the living creatures of the living earth. Pleasure in color, form, and movement, awareness of the amazing diversity of life, and the enjoyment of natural beauty are of man's heritage as a living creature. Our first conscious acquaintance with the subject should come, if possible, through nature, in fields and forests and on the shore. Secondarily, and by way of amplification and verification, we should then explore its laboratory aspects. Some of the most gifted and imaginative biologists have first approached their subject through the medium of sensory impression and emotional response. The most memorable writings, though they be addressed in intellect, are rooted in man's emotional reaction to that life stream of which he is part. The writing of the great naturalists such as Hudson and Thoreau, most easily sampled in some of the excellent anthologies now available, has a valid place in one's reading in the field of biology. As the frontiers of science expand, there is inevitably an increasing trend towards specialization in which all the mental faculties of man or group of men are brought to bear on a single aspect of some problem. But there is fortunately a counter tendency which brings different specialists together to work in cooperation. Oceanographic expeditions commonly include biologists, chemists, physicists, geologists, meteorologists, so diverse are the problems presented by one aspect of the Earth's surface. Atomic physicists, by discovering that radioactive elements in fossils and minerals disintegrate at a rate may be determined, have provided biologists with a tool that has already revolutionized our concept of the age of the Earth and permits a far more accurate approach than ever before to the problem of evolution of man himself. Chemists and geneticists, by joining forces, seem to be solving the riddle of gene and the actual means by which it produces hereditary characteristics. Only within the 20th century has biology thought to have been focused on ecology or the relation of living creature to its environment. Awareness of ecological relationships is, or should be, the basis of modern conservation programs, for it is useless to attempt to preserve a living species. The kind of land or water it requires is also preserved. So delicately interwoven are the relationships that when we disturb one thread of a community fabric, we alter it all. Perhaps almost imperceptibly, perhaps so drastically that destruction follows. If we have been slow to develop the general concepts of ecology and conservation, we have been even more tardy in recognizing the facts of ecology and the conservation of man himself. We may hope that this will be the next major phase in the development of biology. Here and there, awareness is growing that man, far from being the overlord of all creation, is himself of nature, a subject to the same cosmic forces that control all other life. Man's future welfare and probably even his survival depend on learning to live in harmony rather than combat with these forces. So that first piece was my favorite. I think it gives us a clear understanding of how man fits in and how biology fits in. Study of life is the study of all of the interconnections, bringing us to ecology. So the second piece I'm going to read is called The Edge of the Sea. And I've chosen The Edge of the Sea because Manhattan is surrounded by water. It's all the shorelines are subject to tidal action, and there's an amazing quality of life that's found in this perimeter where the ocean meets the land. So, the edge of the sea. In recent years, I've been dealing with the ecology of the seashore, with the animal and the plant communities of the rocky coasts, the beach sands, the marshes and mudflats, the coral reefs and mangrove swamps. I've been thinking about the relations of one animal to other animals, of animals to plants, of the animal or plant to the physical world about it. Always in such reflections, one is made aware of the complex pattern of life. No thread is found to be complete in itself, nor does it have meaning alone. Each is but a small part of the intricately woven design of the whole, for the living organism is bound to its world by many ties, some of them relating to biology, others to chemistry, geology, or physics. For example, perhaps we discover that an animal we have found year after year in the same place suddenly is found there no more, and eventually it appears that the whole population of this creature has shifted its range, that has done this, moreover, in response to the change in a single factor or of its physical environment, the temperature of the water. Or we may find that a certain marine worm is so specialized that its living requirements that it can so specialized in its living requirements that it can live in only one kind of sand and one only, and moreover, that is very young stages, the larvae whose age is measured in hours or days are able to find and recognize sand of these particular qualities with the precision that few human students of geology could match. Or again, perhaps we discover a sudden and quite mysterious change in the ability of a marine animal to grow and reproduce, or in the ability of its larvae to exist in the accustomed places. And perhaps we are led to suspect a subtle change in the biochemical nature of the seawater. Or any of these things are enough to convince us that we, as biologists, cannot exist in a comfortable ivory tower of our own, that it is quite necessary that we concern ourselves with the related sciences if we are to understand the creatures of the marine world. The edge of the sea is a laboratory in which nature itself is conducting experiments on the evolution of life and the delicate balancing of the living creature within a complex system of forces, living and non-living. We have come a long way from the early days of biology of the shore, when it was enough to find, to describe, and to name the plants and animals found there. We have progressed also beyond the next period, the dawn age of the science of ecology, when it was realized that certain kinds of animals are typical of certain kinds of habitats. Now our minds are occupied with tantalizing questions. Why does an animal live where it does? What is the nature of the ties that bind it to this world? One of the physical ties is especially interesting in this, our present period of Earth's history. It is a force that is omnipresent. No living thing is exempt from its influence. For life, in the aggregate, is lived within a relatively narrow range of temperature. The fact that our planet Earth has a fairly stable temperature helps us to make it hospitable to life. In the sea, especially, temperature changes are gradual and moderate, and many animals are so delicately adjusted that they cannot tolerate an abrupt or extensive change in the temperature of the surrounding water. If such occurs, they must migrate or die. Now our climate is changing, and we are moving into a warm cycle of unknown duration. Ocean temperatures are slower to reflect the change than the air, but there has been a measurable warming of the Atlantic coastal waters. The winter temperatures, which may be the critical ones for some marine animals, are less severe. Also, the water is warmer in summer. Records of winter temperatures in the Gulf of Maine, based on the average records of Boston, Booth Bay Harbor, Eastport, and St. Andrews, show an impressive rise. In 1918, for example, surface temperatures during the coldest months of the year averaged about 28 degrees, and in 1910-1919 decade, temperatures below 32 occurred almost every winter. During the 1930s, however, only 3 years of the decade did the water temperatures in the coldest months average below 32 degrees, and this has not happened in every year since 1940. Last winter's coldest month averaged 38 degrees, or 10 degrees warmer than the winter of 1918, a very substantial increase as the sea temperatures go. It is not surprising that such a change in the oceanic climate should have caused many shifts of distribution along the marine faunas. It is well known that the waters around Greenland and Iceland have been invaded by animals from regions to the south. This has been well documented in papers by Jensen and others. Less has been said about the corresponding changes in the water off the east coast of the United States, but many are occurring, and collectively, they seem to form a significant picture. Take, for example, the green crab. This is a member of the family of swimming crabs to which the blue crab also belongs. Once its range was very restricted. S.I. Smith and Verrill's report on the invertebrate animals of Vineyard Sound gave its distribution as Cape Cod to New Jersey. More than a quarter of a century later, in 1905, Dr. Mary Rathbun placed its northward limit at in Casco Bay. As late as 1930, she reported only one record of its occurrence east of Casco Bay. The 1929 Biological Survey of Mount Desert Island did not include it. However, in 1930, two of the green crabs were collected in the vicinity of Brooklyn in Hancock County, Maine. These were sent to the National Museum because they had been taken so far beyond the limits of their normal range. 9 years later, Leslie W. Scattergood, an FWS scientist of lobster culture, found this species at Winter Harbor, and in 1951 he was able to report its eastward spread to Lubeck. A few months later, he found it on the main shores of Passamaquoddy Bay, and Canadian biologists reported it from Ovenhead to eastern shores of this bay in the same year. According to the biological station at St. Andrews, the green crabs were very abundant and on all the flats of Passamaquoddy Bay in the summer of 1953. When they were also found across the Nova Scotian shores in St. Mary's Bay in August and Minas Basin in November, their record stands for the moment. The spread of the green crab is better documented than most of the species for a practical reason. Its invasion of the soft clam areas of Maine and in some localities almost wiped out of the industry, for the crab preys so extensively on the young stages that forming of clams can be hardly practiced in its presence. However, there are other occurrences perhaps equally interesting. For these largely unpublished records, I am indebted to a number of biologists, including various members of the Fish and Wildlife Service, John N.J. Barrell of McGill University and Fenner Crace of the National Museum. With warming water temperatures, the sea herring is becoming scarce in Maine. Whether this is entirely a matter of temperature or whether diseases or other factors enter the picture, I suppose no one can say with assurance. But as the herring declines, other fish, members of the same family, but more of southern distribution, are moving in. Back in the 1980s, there was a substantial fishery for the Menhaden in Booth Bay and some other Maine ports. Then the fish disappeared from Maine, and for many years has been yielding enormous catches in New Jersey, Virginia, North Carolina, and other southern states. But about 1950, the Menhaden came back to Maine waters in numbers, followed by Virginia boats and fishermen. Then there is another member of the same family, the round herring, in the 1920s, Bigelow. Welsh reported it is occurring from the Gulf of Mexico north only as far as Cape Cod, but it was rare anywhere on the Cape, and the two that had been caught at Provincetown were preserved in the Museum of Contemporary Comparative Zoology. Now, however, immense schools of this fish have been appearing in Maine waters for several years, and the fishing industry is experimenting with canning it. There are negative responses, too. One of the hydroids, a member of the genus Sicornis, is delicately adjusted to water temperatures and has been considered by some key temperature zone organism. Professor N.J. Barrell tells me that 6 years ago, his species was common at North Point near Booth Bay Harbor in June. So is the hydroid clava. Anyway, I think we're going to stop at this stage of the story and go on to another one. That was a fable that was introducing Rachel Carson's story. Hold on just a second. All right, there. Sorry for that dead air. I just thought it might be better to do this fable instead of continuing with that story because that was getting long. So this fable was the beginning of Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, and it's called A Fable of Tomorrow. There was once a town in the heart of America where all life seemed to be in harmony with its surroundings. And again, this is by Rachel Carson, Silent Spring. This town lay in the midst of a checkerboard of prosperous farms with fields of grain and hillsides of orchards, where in spring, white clouds of bloom drifted above the green fields. In autumn, oak and maple and birch set up a blaze of color that flamed and flickered across the backdrop of pines. Then foxes barked in the hills and deer silently crossed the fields, half hidden in the mists of all of the fall mornings. Along the roads, laurel, viburnum, and alder, great ferns and wild flowers, delighted the traveler's eye through much of the year. Even in winter, the roadsides were places of beauty where countless birds came to feed on the berries and the seed heads of the dried weeds rising above the snow. The countryside was in fact famous for the abundance and variety of its bird life, and when the flood of migrants was pouring in through the spring and fall, people traveled from great distances to observe them. Others came to fish in the streams, which flowed clear and cold out of the hills and contained shady pools where trout lay. So it had been from the days, many years ago, when the first settlers raised their houses, sank their wells, and built their barns. Then a strange blight crept over the area and everything began to change. Some evil spell had settled in the community. Mysterious maladies swept the flocks of chickens. The cattle and sheep sickened and died. Everywhere was a shadow of death. The farmers spoke of much illness among their families. In the town, the doctors had become more and more puzzled by new kinds of sicknesses appearing among their patients. There had been several sudden and unexplained deaths, not only among adults, but even among children. Who would be stricken suddenly while at play and die within a few hours? There was a strange stillness. The birds, for example, where had they gone? Many people spoke of them, puzzled and disturbed. The feeding stations in the backyards were deserted. The few birds seen anywhere were moribund, and they trembled violently and could not fly. It was a spring without voices. On the mornings that had once throbbed with the dawn chorus of robins, catbirds, doves, jays, wrens, and scores of other bird voices, there was no sound now. Only silence lay over the fields and woods and marsh. On the farms, hens brooded, but no chicks hatched. The farmers complained that they were unable to raise any pigs. The litters were small, and the young survived only a few days. The apple trees were coming into bloom, but no bees droned among the blossoms. There was no pollination, and there would be no fruit. The roadsides, once so attractive, were now lined with browned and withered vegetation, as though swept by a fire. These two were silent, deserted by all living things. Even the streams were now lifeless. Anglers no longer visited them, for all the fish had died. The gutters under the eaves between the shingles of the roofs, a white granular powder, still showed a few patches some weeks before it had fallen like snow upon the roofs and lawns in the fields and streams. No witchcraft, no enemy action had silenced the rebirth of life in this stricken world. The people had done it themselves. And that's the end. So thank you very much to NPR.
Thank you very much, Amber.
Come and read this.
Yeah. And again, you should go to art-echo.org and take a look for Mission Greenbelt, and you can just Google Mission Greenbelt, I guess.
Easy to remember. Yeah.
Even though it's still ongoing, I guess it's.
Yeah, it's going to be ongoing for a couple of years. It's a long-term project.
Well, I guess there's probably no end to sidewalk either, so it might not end in 2 years.
It's an initiative, so hopefully it will go on for many years.
Oh, good. All right, well, up next, we're waiting for Weldon, and we'll be back in a minute on your Neighborhood Public Radio.
Thank you.